Welcome to the second edition of the new NCMC podcast series. I'm Joe Blumenthal, your host. And today we're talking to Emily Green, who teaches at the Community Music Center and who is playing that lovely Bach Gavotte. And I guess I just want to start off by asking you to describe your role at the Music Center, what you teach, how many students you have, stuff like that.
Sure. I teach Suzuki violin and viola, and I'm also the director of the Suzuki program at the Music Center. And I think right now I have about 20 students. I also teach two of the advanced violin group classes as well. One of the most advanced one has between 10 and 15 students in it generally. And then the other group I teach has another 5 students in it.
Okay, and those are still going on during the pandemic?
Yes, we're doing all of those things over Zoom.
Wow, okay, that's great. Well, the main thing I wanted to talk to you about today was to talk about what Suzuki is and how it works at the Music Center. And perhaps you could start off just with a description of what makes the Suzuki method special, what makes it different from other ways of learning violin.
Sure. I would say that the main thing that's different about the Suzuki approach is the way we think of it as being a language. And so we can learn a musical instrument the same way we learn a language. So of course, when we're first learning to speak, before we even say a word, we're surrounded by other people talking to us. And we hear a lot of the different sounds that go into language. And at the earliest moments, we try to make our own sounds, even though we can't even make words. At first, we just make sounds. And then we put those sounds together and we make words. And of course, when we make those words as a tiny child, our parents go crazy with excitement. Which encourages us to make more sounds and put together more words and build on that. And Dr. Suzuki's idea is very similar, that for each instrument, there's a recording that students listen to every day, ideally. And that's how they're sort of training their brains to learn a new language.
So they start listening to this recording even before they pick up the violin?
That's right. In the traditional Suzuki method, a parent, in traditional Japan, it was often the mom, would actually learn to play the violin first, with the idea that young kids are a lot more excited to do things when they see their parent doing it first. So while they're learning the beginning skills of learning an instrument, they're also listening to the recording. Of course, back then it was a tape. We don't have tapes anymore, but now there are much more sophisticated ways to listen to our recordings. But at that point, it was listening to a tape, and the young child would be watching the parent also learn to play the instrument first.
Uh-huh. And how young do they start?
At NCMC, I think we start them usually no younger than 3. I have started some students who are younger than 3, but it just kind of depends on the readiness of the student. Some kids are ready at 3, some kids are ready at 4, some kids are ready at 5, and any skilled teacher can assess a student and see what they're ready for.
I know that you do a lot of different instruments with Suzuki at NCMC. Could you learn any instrument with Suzuki, or are there certain instruments that it's best limited to?
There are certain instruments, but there are more all the time. Originally, Dr. Suzuki was interested in violin, and then we have a viola method, we have a cello method, we have a double bass method, we have piano, there's flute, there's guitar. I recently learned that there's also recorder, and now there's Suzuki voice as well. So. The method, I think, can be applied to a lot of different instruments. And, we do have quite a few of those at NCMC. But my suspicion is in the upcoming years, even more instruments will be available.
You think there'll ever be Suzuki drums?
I think there could be. Why not?
I don't know. Drums are so different. They're so primal. I mean, kids bang on things with no very easily. Anyway, do you ever have... Is Suzuki just for kids, or do sometimes teens or adults use a Suzuki method to learn?
They do. In fact, just in the last year at NCMC, we started an adult Suzuki class. It's a group class. but I know that several of us have worked with adult students. You know, the method still applies and it still works no matter how old you are.
I know that, you know, once the students start going through the books, they start reading as well as playing by ear. Is that right? Eventually?
That's right. That's right. You know, initially, it's actually been a big uphill battle in the United States. There was this, originally when Dr. Suzuki came here, I think it was in the 50s, maybe the 60s, he traveled around with this amazing group of young musicians, and so many teachers were astounded at the high level. And so they were ready to adopt this method. And so for the first 10 years, they did everything that Dr. Suzuki did. And then after 10 years, they had students who couldn't read music. And come to find out, in Japan, reading music is taught in public school. So that wasn't something that was that the string teachers needed to teach to their students. It's something they were already learning. And so, you know, of course correction here in the States. and since then, we've all realized, we need to be teaching reading right along with, you know, in the later stages. I mean, of course, it's not really appropriate for a three-year-old. Just like in English, we wouldn't teach them to read books. We would, of course, even for 3 and 4 year olds, be teaching them. We'd be reading to them, and we would be showing them the letters. And we do that in the Suzuki method. But generally, we start introducing some reading at the same time developmentally that they would learn to read English. So, as I said, we'd learn some pre-reading skills, like learning our notes and working on our rhythms. I really aim to have my students have their reading more or less catch up with their playing by about book 4. But, you know, especially now with the option to join orchestras, there's a lot more motivation and interest for kids to be learning to read. You know, I would say Suzuki students, they have that skill of being able to play something by ear, which never goes away. And I think for some kids, it makes learning to read a little bit harder because they can revert back to the skill of listening, but most of the kids become proficient readers.
So is there time when with your students that you stop emphasizing learning by ear and mainly work on learning by reading music?
I would say both of those things happen simultaneously. You know, one of Suzuki's big goals for his students is a focus on tone. And particularly for kids who aren't from a musical home, you know, a lot of my students don't have any parents or family members that play an instrument. There's nowhere else that they're going to be learning that tone other than from a recording. And Dr. Suzuki would say, you know, he wants students to be hearing more of what they're aspiring to be rather than more of themselves. So the theoretical idea is that they're hearing more of the recording of what they want to be mimicking rather than hearing themselves play. So yes, of course, you know, especially advanced students, of course, we're going to work on other technical aspects other than just the listening aspect and learning by ear. But there are things that they're learning to do that aren't just about learning the notes, you know, or the rhythms that they can learn through listening.
I want to go back to Dr. Suzuki for just a second. How old was Dr. Suzuki when he went to
I don't know. He was a young man. I think maybe in his 20s.
And did he play violin then?
He did. His father was actually a violin maker. In fact, even now, a lot of the violins we see say Suzuki on them. They were made, you know, they weren't made by his father. They're made by the factory now. But his father was a violin maker, so he was really surrounded by that as a child.
So his father actually made violins on a commercial scale in the Suzuki name.
I'm not sure. I think he may have still been making them by hand. I think it didn't become commercial until a little bit later in Dr. Suzuki's life.
So, but the revelation about teaching came as a result of his trying to learn German and thinking about how the similarities between that and trying to learn music.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, he also, one of his other big tenets is talking about ability, that every child has the ability to learn. You know, and I think that's a really important and foundational tenet of his method, that, you know, it's, we, you know, we all may have different levels of ability. He's not stating that we all would learn things at the same rate, but that the ability is actually there, and it's all about nurturing that ability and putting the work in, to create habits and to create foundational skills, and that, you know, really any child can learn. In fact, I know he had some kids, you know, with difficulties that would make it seemingly, you know, difficult to learn. Like, I think there was one person who was missing fingers, and so he had them switch around the violin. So instead of playing on the left shoulder, they were playing on the right shoulder, because that way in the bow hand, they could put the hand with missing fingers on the bow hand and still play. So, you know, even kids who had, you know, what was considered deformities at that point, could still learn to play an instrument.
That's very interesting, because there's so many people that you run into that said, well, I'm totally not musical. I could never do that. And whereas the fact is, most people can learn on some level.
Yeah.
So tell us something about how you use group learning in the Suzuki program.
Sure. Well, of course, right now we're in sort of a funny spot with the pandemic, and group has changed a lot, but it's happening still for all of the levels. In more traditional group, when we're not in a pandemic, when we're able to get together, group serves a lot of purposes. One of them is a social purpose, and that's social not just for the kids, but also for the parents. I've heard parents describe group class time as a support network. It's their chance to talk with other parents about how things are going at home. But for kids, they're learning lots of things. In addition to the social, they're reinforcing all of the skills that they've already learned. So generally in group, kids are going to be working on repertoire that is review for them. It's old. So that they can be working on, you know, really refining the skills that they've learned. Group class should also be fun. I mean, you know, you're also with other kids, so you can play games and you can, you know, do silly things. Sometimes we do new rep in group, or we learn a fiddle tune or something else that's sort of fun. We also work on technique. In my more advanced group, sometimes we have, it's a master class set up where we're listening to, you know, we're all listening to one person play and then all giving our critique, and then a teacher will also give some ideas at the end. So group really has a lot of different purposes.
What you mentioned fiddle tunes. Is that, you know, and there's kind of a divide, you know, in the world of violin between fiddle and violin, and people think of classical as one thing and fiddle music as something else. To Suzuki, is it common for the kids in a Suzuki to spend some time working on fiddle tunes that they might learn by ear also?
Yes, I've really found there's such a nice segue from learning Suzuki to learning fiddle tunes, because in a lot of ways, that's what we're learning at the very beginning, right? We're learning these folk tunes. Uh-huh. Some of them are from Germany, because that's where Dr. Suzuki studied, but it's really pretty similar. I think it's pretty exciting for kids to realize that this skill of listening and then playing something back applies to all kinds of genres of music. So I actually think fiddle tunes really, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, in fact, in my own violin history, I started violin when I was 2.5, and my family lived in Newfoundland, Canada. And as you may know, there's a heavy fiddle presence there.
Yes.
You know, a lot of Irish people, and the, you know, PEI is nearby. And so in the Suzuki program where I grew up, it was part of our Saturday morning group class. So, you know, you would have your weekly lesson, and you would have your weekly group class, and you would have your weekly orchestra, and you would have weekly fiddle class. And sometimes that was taught by, you know, a toothless old man who was a fiddler from the island who would come and teach fiddle tunes. So for me personally, fiddling is an integral part of a Suzuki program, again, because of my own experience. But yes, I think even in programs not on Newfoundland Island, I think it's still, it's pretty common, yeah, to be working on some fiddle tunes.
You've been talking a lot about Dr. Suzuki, and I know he wrote a book, which is kind of the basis of the program, called Nurture by Love, which I guess a lot of people are supposed to read that are involved in this. So tell us a little bit about that book, about, you know, what people get out of it when they read it.
Sure. Nurtured by Love is a very compelling and inspiring book. In fact, one of his proteges, Michelle George, actually made a DVD, an hour-long DVD with the principles of it, which is also very moving. But the idea is he talks a little bit about how he came to develop his method. And it's a little bit about what I talked about earlier. You know, Dr. Suzuki, after the war, went to Germany and really saw all of the destruction and difficulty in the world in the war, both in his home Japan and also in Germany. And yet he also encountered all of these children in particular, and he talked about the sort of spirit of the child and how he was looking to children to rebuild this damaged world. And he talks in his book about the language aspect of this too, that here he was, a very smart Japanese man who had shown up in Germany later in his life and was really struggling to learn German. And yet he would talk with these young 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds who had a great command of their native tongue. And this is how he taught, you know, how he learned to apply this to music. He also talks about what his goals are in terms of musical education for children. And he talks about what he wants is basically world peace and cooperation. And I think especially in times like now, or really every decade, this is really appealing to a lot of families, that we're not just learning music so that we have this specific skill of playing an instrument. The idea is that we're learning something that helps us to nurture our heart and helps us connect with other people who may or may not speak our same language.
That's great. I actually recently read a book called Children of the Stone. Did you ever read that?
No, I don't know that book.
You should read it. It's about a Palestinian stone kid who grew up throwing stones in the Intifada, but somehow he managed to get turned on to music, and he actually became a viola player, and he actually started a music school in Ramallah to try and give something that was good and joyful to all these kids that grew up in this desperate situation. I recommend it very highly.
Yeah, that's great.
When you do you have a musical life outside of NCMC? Do you do performing at all, or are members of any groups?
You know, right now, I mean, again, because of the pandemic, I'm not. When it's not pandemic season, I do sometimes, you know, play for weddings and other kinds of gigs like that. I myself have 4 children, so it's difficult for me to do much outside of my work and my home life. But I know that there are so many great groups, and I know a lot of NCMC's faculty do participate in, you know, various orchestras and chamber groups and other sorts of performing groups.
Do your kids play?
The oldest 2 do. My oldest, my stepson plays viola. He is 9. And my daughter, who is 8, plays cello, both at NCMC.
Great. As a bass player, I kind of know the answer to this question, but it always amazes me that you have this instrument that has a plain fingerboard on it, and you make the notes by pushing your finger down on the fingerboard. But how in the world is it possible to find an accurate note on a fingerboard that has no reference points at all, unlike a guitar, which has frets, which give you in a very, very exact way of playing notes?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I think it's a funny thing for parents are asking me sometimes about what instrument should their child play. And we sometimes talk about a child who really needs some instant gratification. But sometimes piano is a good place to start, because as you're saying with guitar, it's like, if you press the key, you're going to hear the note, you know. Right. And on a string instrument like bass, you know, which you play, or violin or viola or cello, it's true. It's really difficult with no reference points. And for kids, we actually start by putting some guides on for them. We put tape. In fact, usually violin teachers use car detailing tape. It's the only time I go to an auto supply store is to get tape they put on cars, because it doesn't damage the fingerboard. So right at the beginning of learning, we do generally put 3 or 4 tapes on the fingerboard as guides. And pretty soon, if the child is really listening to the recording, very early on, a child is able to self-correct and find the note that they're looking for. And the tapes actually become more useful for the parent who's watching the kid, because it tends to be that kids' ears develop more quickly than their parents. So, you know, at the beginning, they have some guidelines. And then really just through listening, kids can have really very subtle changes, and their intonation gets good very quick.
Speaking of parents, you know, I know it's in a Suzuki program, it's common to get the parents to try and play the instrument also. Do many parents actually really learn to play and so that they would keep playing even after they don't need to help their kids in the learning anymore? Does it usually fall off?
Yeah, usually the kids surpass the adults and the adults don't do it anymore. You know, I think what happens is the parents, you know, usually the parent starts out strong and they are a little ahead of the kids, and then they practice with the kids and the kids usually pass them up by the middle to end of book one. And I think whether it's, you know, disheartening for the parents or whether, you know, they're just trying to give their kids the time that it takes to practice every day. But, you know, I have to say, I mentioned earlier that we started a program for adult musicians, and I think four of the people who joined all had kids who had taken an instrument, and I think all but one of them, the kids had way surpassed, you know, by books, had surpassed the adults, but the adults still wanted to come back to it and learn it sort of at their own pace. So I think it plants a seed for some adults. I would say the majority of adults, again, they don't continue on with it, but for some, I think it is still interesting to them, and they do come back to it.
What's it like when the parent of the kid is actually a musician who really knows how to play? Does that make it easier or
it harder? Does make it easier. Yeah, I do have one of my students right now. So I had two students until they were in high school. And the mom is actually a music professor in a local university. And she's a pianist by training, but she had always talked about doing violin. And once her kids made it to high school, she decided that she wanted to start as well. She had been a Suzuki pianist growing up. And, you know, it's just interesting. You know, she, of course, already knows how to read music. So that made it a lot easier for her. She'd already heard these specific pieces for years because her kids had been playing them. And of course, she just has a general sort of musical base. You know, that said, my first ever adult student almost 20 years ago now did end up joining a local community orchestra after a few years of studying with me. So, you know, I guess they're, you know, adults have different paths, but I think adults who are really interested in it can be successful.
Do you have, who's your favorite composer, and what sort of music do you really like to listen to, and what sort of music do you like to play when you play?
I guess I really like romantic composers. You know, I really love Brahms. I grew up attending chamber music camps. That was sort of my big event of the summer. And I think Brahms chamber music feels like the pinnacle for me. You know, really, really quality music to listen to and play. So I think I would say Brahms is number one. And I think any romantic composer is very compelling to me.
Okay. Do you ever... But do you still play fiddle tunes that like you learned when you were growing up?
Yeah, I do. You know, I also almost 20 years ago now, I had a career as a singer-songwriter, and I played guitar. And I did that. I actually had two CDs that I recorded. One was my senior project in college, and then I recorded another a couple years later. But I was gigging, and I had a friend I played with who is also a guitarist and a bassist, and so we would open up all of our shows with a couple of Newfoundland fiddle tunes. So that was sort of, you know, a fun thing to do in the shows that I was playing at that time.
So do you play other? So you play. So do you still play guitar, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, again, my having four children under the age of 10 limits my ability to do much other than take care of them. But I do have a guitar. In fact, recently I got an alto, baritone ukulele for a friend. It was actually my Christmas present last year, and so that's been really fun to kind of play with. Well,
Is there a Suzuki ukulele program?
I don't know, but I suspect there will be soon if there isn't one yet.
So ukulele is kind of the cheap, I like to describe it as the cheap gateway drug into music, because it's so easy to do things that you can sing along with.
Yeah.
And, but it's kind of the opposite of violin, which is very demanding. And could you talk just a little bit about how you have adapted your teaching and both individually and group to the necessities of the pandemic?
Sure. You know, one thing that I just feel overwhelmingly grateful for and proud of is the way my students have responded to this kind of a change. The majority of my students have been with me for many years. You know, the bulk of my studio is middle school and high school students. And, you know, it's the biggest drawback of this, I mean, there are lots of drawbacks, I guess, but the difficult thing is not being able to play duets, which is a way that I often end my lessons with students, is we sight read duets, which I think that has so many, positive effects, not just the sight reading, but playing with somebody else. And I really miss that part of it. But, you know, my students have been so flexible and so fabulous at adapting to this new way of doing things. The week that MCMC closed, the week that sort of the world closed, the middle of March, I had already scheduled a week off the next week. And so I had sort of a week to get everything together. And then the following week, everybody showed up for their Zoom lesson. And I've had, you know, almost nobody miss in the last several months. So, you know, we pretty much just do the same things we did in our face-to-face lessons. You know, everyone has a practice sheet that they fill out themselves, and we check in at the beginning of every week about how the practice week went, and we go through their etudes, we go through their scales, we go through their pieces. So, you know, again, it's a little difficult sometimes to work on some of the intricacies and some of the tone. Right. But for so many of these students, they know what they're listening for. I'm more of a cheerleader to remind them. You know, and even for the little kids, the parents have really stepped in for the little kids to help them. I've actually started 3 new students during the pandemic. Huh. And this was possible because parents, you know, had some musical experience and could help their kids at home. But, you know, I'm amazed by the innovation that parents have made and the flexibility that kids have shown. So, uh-huh. You know, individual lessons, again, it's a little strange because we can't play together. I also miss the kids getting to see each other in between the lessons and sort of passing in the hall. But the group classes, we've also changed up a little bit. The most advanced group classes now, we work on scales, but it's really a masterclass format since there's no way to work to play together. But just right. In this coming semester, I have 5 Book 4 students, and we're actually going to use an app called Upbeat Music App. And we're going to record some things. So everyone will get their own part. I'll send, you know, email out everyone's part. They'll all learn it. And then we'll each put in our recording and make a final product. Right. So of course, it's not the same as being in person, but I think that, you know, the kids will learn other skills by doing that. You know, we've also had a chance to do a little bit more with music theory, which we can do online. We've done a little bit more learning about composers. So, you know, it's we've kept it going. I'm looking forward to being back in person again, but it's, you know, again, all of our...
Aren't we all?
Exactly. But, you know, I'm again, impressed by the innovation the teachers have shown too at keeping this all going. In fact, just a couple of days ago, one of our fabulous teachers, Capella Sherwood, organized a New Year's Eve play-in with 20 pieces for 2020. And I think they learned a couple fiddle tunes on that too. So, you know, just a lot of really good creative thinking to keep people engaged.
Yeah. Anyway, well, I think I've used up all the questions that I had to ask you about. So I guess it's time to say thank you for taking the time to do this. And I'm kind of hoping that, you know, this is going to be kind of a permanent, the access to it will be on the Music Center website. I'm kind of hoping that, like, if a parent comes in and has a question about Suzuki, Jason can say to them, oh, well, go to the podcast and you'll learn about the Suzuki by listening to Emily talk about it. So hoping it turns into something like that.
Yeah, well, that would be great. And we're always interested in inviting in new families into the program. Right. It's a very nice, you know, warm, welcoming group. It's really sweet, you know, to see the kids who have gone through the program who are now in college, who, you know, their families still keep in touch. So I think it really is a really special world. Not, you know, the nice thing too is even if you enter just through NCMC, there are so many opportunities to connect with other Suzuki students, right. You know, in a community way here in the Valley. There's also institutes that happen all across the world. So it's really a very special, it's a very special group to be part of.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
We're going to go out listening to Emily play the most famous thing that every Suzuki player plays, Twinkle. And here she is.